You know, you look at that and you realize, wow, there are some very, very distinct and intense differences between religions and spiritualities. And any of the committed adherents to any one of those religions would be insulted to say that all religions, all the spiritualities are the same. They're not. However, there are certain patterns that do run throughout all religions, all spiritualities. One of them is the trying to make sense of the pain in this life and the difficulty that we have here. How do I get to a new and better place? There's values that cut across all religions and spiritualities, like it's not good to kill somebody in cold-blooded murder, it's good to tell the truth, all these sort of things. Another one that exists is this need to lean into my own abilities, lean into my own efforts, lean into my own pursuit of knowledge. I need to somehow leverage the principle of karma, realize it is at the center of the universe, and my actions will get something back. And this, in some way, shape, or form, goes across all these. Sort of the idea of I've got to even everything out. If I got a lot of bad stuff over there, I got to do some good stuff and just try to even it out. And hopefully all my good stuff will outweigh the bad stuff and I can get on to the next life, get on to enlightenment. Can I keep coming back as a different form or keep becoming a different form of myself right now? But ultimately, it's really all about my efforts and all of what I'm supposed to do and all that is apparently good and right. And that's the law of fairness. Fairness. And this cuts across our society today. We are so, so into fair. You know, we're taking a look at our economy hurting, and we're trying to point the finger, find out who's wrong. And of course, we find out Wall Street executives and how much they earn. And it's like, you know, that's just not fair. No one should earn that kind of money. That is absolutely not fair. Presidents on their way out often pardon people who they knew so they don't get punishment. And we'll say, that's not fair. And we don't like death row pardons either. And we go to a Little League game. Man, you'll find fairness being screamed all over the place there. I mean, everyone's upset that something isn't fair or something isn't right or anything like that. Octomom. Who thinks of these names? Octomom. I mean, my goodness, you know, Octomom is a woman that had eight children and people feeling really bad for her until she goes and buys makeup at Needless Markup or Neiman Marcus or one of those things anyway. She buys the makeup there and everyone's all bummed out because that's just not fair. People have given her all this money, the baby's this money. You shouldn't be going out and spending it at high-end stores. See, all these are examples of how our fairness comes into play and how we interpret all of these things. And that's why this verse by Jesus bothers us so much. It goes like this, John 14:6. Jesus says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Come on, that is ridiculous. That just doesn't seem fair. That seems like the ultimate in spiritual snobbery. Jesus saying, I'm the way, nothing else matters. This just doesn't seem fair because fairness is to us, we want things kind of balanced out amongst all spiritualities and everything needs to be fair that way. This just really rubs us wrong. Now, he absolutely did say this, we talked about last week. And as the expert in our video at the beginning of the service said, of course, those of you who were late didn't see that. You ought to try coming on time sometime. You'll like get all kind of good stuff. But we can be very certain that he actually said that for a variety of reasons. Oh, he might have been wrong. He absolutely could have been wrong. But what we're going to look at today was what's the heart behind that idea? Well, what's going on there? And what we're trying to do today and throughout the series, we're not trying to defend Christianity. We're not trying to defend or explain even Christianity as religion. Of course, Christianity as religion probably has the most things in common with Jesus as any other religion. But nonetheless, I don't have really any energy for defending Christianity. There's a lot of things that Christianity has done or been about and for years and ages that I just personally don't want to be a part of at all. I don't want to nail my color to the mast on some of the racist things that have happened in the name of Christianity, the crusades that have happened in the name of Christianity, even back in the 1500s, 1600s, killing fellow Christians who had different views on baptism. Like, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I just really have no interest to talk about or defend the official religion of Christianity. We're looking in this whole journey is Jesus. Let's reset our assumptions on who Jesus is. And let's take a look at one person's story, Allison.
Hi, my name is Allison. Overall, I was one of those people that when I started to figure out who this Jesus character was, I still considered myself a nice person. Like, I gave a rip about other people, and I liked to do volunteer things. So there was a part of me that felt like, I don't need a Jesus because I'm all right. I'm a happy, nice person. Until I really came to know him, and knowing having my life since, I've kind of figured out on some level who Jesus is just dramatically different in really rich ways. But before I figured out who Jesus was, I was honestly really turned off by him. I was awkward because I definitely had like tracts handed to me and had, you know, several people in high school that were fairly hypocritical that were doing Jesus-y stuff on one day and then dramatically different stuff on the next day. So I didn't like a lot of the hypocrisy that I saw there. I was very uncomfortable with even just the name Jesus in any talk. I didn't really grow up knowing much of who he was, and I quite honestly didn't know if he actually really existed. Was he a real dude, or is it just some historical figure? And there was a point where I reached in life where I was like, I'm either totally nuts, or there has to be a better way, and I haven't figured it out yet. And so I did everything in my power, from going to see a counselor to, and at the time I was putting myself through college and working full time, and I quit smoking, I started playing soccer again, and I loved nature. I was spending more time just outside, hanging out in the woods, and I was doing everything I could that I could figure out that felt like forward positive movement. And there was still, I remember distinctly this moment, sitting, hanging out in the woods, and I literally was looking around. Like, all this stuff makes me feel like there's a God. But there's still something missing. I don't know what this God looks like. Did he really create all of this beautiful world around me and all these natural things that I really appreciate? But I just remember feeling like a big emptiness, something missing. And I was like, I am ready to figure out what this is. And there was actually an older woman that I knew who said, maybe it's a God hole. And literally, that was one of the most powerful comments I have ever heard in my life, because it kind of connected the emptiness that I couldn't fill with the idea of God. And so from then, I just started seeking out, all right, so what does that look like? Who is this God person? Part of it was, there's only so much I realized that I could go and find out on my own. And part of it was, I feel like Jesus just coming in and showing me who he was. Hearing other people's around me as I started to talk to more people who were really following this Jesus guy, who were actually real people. They weren't like quiet ladies who sit around and have tea parties, which is some baggage that I kind of assumed that that's what a Christian woman is. They were women who once in a while they actually would cuss, and once in a while they were just real, and they wanted to know my story, and they started loving on me, and they started telling me what Jesus had done in their life. And I'm like, how do I know he's really a person though? How do I really know that he existed? You know, people are saying, hey, why don't you just pray about it? Why don't you just ask God? Like, prayer doesn't have to be this big formulaic intense thing. Just be like, hey, dude, God, is Jesus real? What does that mean for me? What does that look like? Will you just show me? And so I feel like then people started kind of telling me their stories, and I started to get a bigger picture of Jesus, for all these real people around me, equaled total life change. My life is so dramatically different in really significant ways. Like, you know, I used to really struggle with anxiety and depression and just have a lot of self-doubt and be really insecure. And although those things aren't just 100% wiped clean now that I believe in Jesus, I just don't struggle. The amount of like peace that I feel now, the amount of like, you know what? I'm here for a reason. I feel like Jesus is walking through this life with me. Once I really understood, Jesus put himself through the most torturous death possible willingly for me, for Allison. And every single individual can say that. Once I got that, then it started to sink in. That means I'm really valuable. Like, that means that if he's willing to do that just so I can have a relationship with him, that means I'm really worth something. It was a big revelation to understand Jesus is completely invested in who I am. Jesus totally wants to build me up. Anytime I'm hearing like a bunch of negative things about myself, I know that that is not coming from him and that he's right there with me. Like, he wants to hold my hand when I'm nervous about something. He wants to make sure that I'm okay and that I feel safe and that I feel loved. So once I started to understand those concepts, then yeah, that is absolutely a revolutionary change from some dude that I feel awkward around who people want to pass me information about, but I still, like, I don't understand and I don't know why he wants to have anything to do with me. It was kind of just that he's for me, he's about me, he wants to hang out with me, he wants to celebrate with me, when I'm really upset, he's right there next to me, like giving me a big hug because he's upset that I'm upset. Once I started to get that, that just blew my mind because I didn't know any of that.
Now, remember, we're on a journey here, fully orb, multi-pronged journey with all kinds of sensory things that we're doing. I don't expect today you to believe everything that's being said today or understand everything. I mean, even that's kind of weird when you think about it. Well, you're talking about Jesus, using the first thing, this person who isn't around on earth any longer physically. What does that mean? Well, we're just going to keep looking at this stuff and see what actually sinks into us. But if you notice what she says there, she doesn't say, Christianity, the religion of Christianity, the right set of beliefs and do's and don'ts really helped me. That's not what she said. In fact, people had a hard time understanding early followers of Jesus in the first century because they didn't do the religious things that people expected out of religious spiritual people. They would go to the early followers of Jesus and say, well, where's your temple? And they'd say, well, we don't have a temple. We don't need a place for God to dwell. Actually, God lives in us. You don't have a temple. Okay, well, where do you do sacrifices? Well, we don't need to do sacrifices. We don't kill things. Doesn't need to happen any longer. In fact, Jesus was our sacrifice. It was very unfair from the dying on a cross for us, but he did, and we don't need to do sacrifices. So don't sacrifice. Well, then what do the religious paid professionals do who represent you before God? What do those people do? Well, we don't need anybody to represent us before God. We can go to God directly. And they go, what are you talking about? In fact, the Romans refer to the early followers of Jesus as atheists. They couldn't categorize them. You must not believe in any real God. You're not any part of a religious system we've ever seen or understood. And people were just always being bothered by Jesus because they kept trying to make sure everything was fair, tit for tat, this equals that. And Jesus comes on a completely different playing field, entirely different playing field, aside from any other religious or spiritual system at all. And this is why he kept getting in trouble with people. And this happens in the book of Luke as we should just be about over with it or on our way to over with it. If you've been doing your homework, boy, homework, ugh. I keep trying to find a different word to say than homework, but you do it. It is work and it is home, so homework. We've been reading through the book of Luke, and there's a story that came up that I've read a lot. I've talked about it a lot, but man, I've seen it with some fresh eyes today. And this is in large part due to a book I read recently, had a big impact on me. If you want to do a deeper dive on this, I highly recommend this book called The Prodigal God by Tim Keller. The scene of the story is when Jesus is spending time with two distinct people, groups of people who are both there. The totally unspiritual, unreligious, doing whatever the heck they want outside of the circle, and then the totally religious, spiritual who are inside of the circle. And it says this in Luke chapter 15, verse 1 to 2. It says, now the tax collectors and sinners were all gathering around to hear Jesus, but the Pharisees and the teachers of the law muttered, this man welcomes sinners and eats with them. Mutter, 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 mutter. He does that mutter. I can't believe he's doing it. Everyone's all upset at what Jesus is doing because this is just not fair. You shouldn't be out spending time with people who don't like God, spending time with people who are doing crazy, crazy, and also happily fun things outside of the religious circles. This is crazy. People didn't understand. The religious people were getting all upset with them. And so Jesus tells three stories back to back to back. First story, he says, hey, there's a shepherd, loses one sheep, got 99 sheep, leaves the 99 sheep and goes looking for the one sheep. And so then there's a woman, she's got 10 coins. She can't find one coin. She leaves the 9 coins and goes in search of the one coin. And then he says it the same thing 3 times. The rule of 3 is a great way to get your point across. Says, now there is a son that's lost. Now this story is not called the prodigal son. Many of us know it as the story of the prodigal son, but Jesus doesn't refer to this story as the prodigal son. It's not in your Bible. If it is, it's because somebody just put a little title above it just to help them understand where it was in the Bible. But that's what we're going to talk about today, this story that Jesus talks about, which shows that he is not fair, that life is not fair, and that he operates on a different plane. Here's how it goes. Jesus continued, there was a man who had 2 sons. The younger one said to his father, "Father, give me my share of the estate." So he divided his property between them. Not long after that, the younger son got together all he had, set off for a distant country, and there squandered his wealth in wild living. After he had spent everything, there was a severe famine in that whole country, and he began to be in need. So he went and hired himself out to a citizen of that country who sent him to his fields to feed pigs. He longed to fill his stomach with the pods that the pigs were eating, but no one gave him anything. When he came to his senses, he said, "How many of my father's hired servants have food to spare? And here I am, starving to death. I'll set out and go back to my father and say to him, 'Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I am no longer worthy to be called your son. Make me like one of your hired servants.'" So he got up and went to his father. There's two kinds of people in this room. There's younger sons and older sons. There's actually three characters in this story. There's the younger son. There's the father who represents God. I'm sorry to tell you, nobody in here is God, though you act like it. There's God, and then there is, or a person next to you acts like it, actually, not you. And then there is the elder son. There's younger sons, and there's elder sons. And actually, as you take a look at this story that Jesus tells, this is a parable. Means it didn't actually happen, but it could have happened. And it's actually the longest and in-depth parable that he says. So this really must strike to the heart of something he's passionate about in the heart of his identity and how he perceives and interacts with God. And this parable has three equal sections. If you look in your Bible, the book of Luke, you'll be, and if you don't have one that you can understand, you can go out to the information center and get one after the service. You can actually see that the three sections are divided up equally. Defining the younger brother, defining what's going on with God, the father figure, and then defining the elder brother. Now, this younger brother operates the way all of us do, operates according to the fairness. Fairness, saying, you know, this just is not fair. This is not right. I'm back here doing my dad's business. I'm building his estate. And all the while, there's a whole world for me to experience that I'm not going to experience. I mean, by the time this guy dies, I'm not going to have any energy to really enjoy life. I'm going to need Viagra. This is actually in the translation. He actually says, I need to enjoy my youth. I need to enjoy my virility. I need to enjoy my energy right now and go, because this is unfair. It's unfair for me to sit and slave right now when the whole world is there to be experienced. So he goes to his dad and says, "Dad, I'd like my share of the estate right now, please. Could you give me my share of the estate?" Now, to a father, when a son would come saying, "I'd like my part of the will right now," what he's in essence saying to him is, "Dad, I wish you were dead. I wish you were dead." I mean, this is just a hurtful thing for any father to hear, especially one in ancient Middle Eastern culture. So the dad divests himself of his property, gives it to him. It's not like he's got these nice brokerage accounts. To do this, he would have had to sell off land. That's where your holdings were. If you're rich, it was because of your land holdings. So he actually sells off, gives him land. He probably liquidates the land. And the younger son gets what he thinks is fair, enjoying life while he can. He's out. He's enjoying it. He's, you know, wine, women, and songing it. He's having a great time. He blows through all his money, loses everything, finds himself doing menial labor, feeding pigs. Now, in a Jewish culture, this is the lowest of the low. Jesus was a Jew. This is the lowest of the low, feeding pigs, because pigs are unkosher. For those of you who are Jewish, I'm sorry. I feel for you, man. Bacon is awesome. Bacon. Bacon on anything goes good. In fact, I actually read something in a food magazine where they're actually adding bacon to desserts. They find you can actually wrap ice cream in bacon. There's fascinating things with bacon. Not to rub it in, but it's really good. So he's kind of feeding these pigs, totally now abandoning his religion of origin as a sign that he is so far gone, and he realizes, man, I could be doing better work, getting better pay if I was one of my father's hired servants. I know, I'm going to go back and just tell my dad, "Hey, I'll work for you. Just take me on as one of your hired servants. See, because when you're going to play the fair game, you always got to play the fair game. That's what he does. It's not fair for me to be wasting away my life and my virility by staying here. I'm going to go out. He blows off everything, and he knows now it's only fair that he can't come back as a son. He's going to work his way. He's going to come back as a hired servant and just make a living, because it wouldn't be fair to him to come back into his dad's house and have the same bedroom and the same standing. He gave that up. It's no more. Not fair. And this is what those of us who are younger brothers are like. You feel like God's somehow holding out on you. It's too boring to be around him. There's something better that awaits. And so there's a natural tendency to rebel, a natural tendency to think that if you're honoring God, your life isn't going to be as fun, a natural curiosity of what's out there. You think God's holding out on you. You've got to constantly be pushing it. And then when you get out there, then you realize it's not all that. There's some pain that comes along with it. It might be a year later, might be 30 years later. Then you realize, man, maybe I want God, but you can't really get back to God because you feel like you got to do fairness and just work off your debt. And so therefore, God, you never really experience the forgiveness of God. You never really experience the mercy of God because you feel like you've got to earn God's favor. You've got to earn his mercy. And so your whole life is spent just like doing the right spiritual thing, trying to be true to your beliefs and all of this stuff. And this son starts coming back, and the father, well, it says this, while he was still a long way off, his father saw him and was filled with compassion for him. He ran to his son, threw his arms around him, and kissed him. The son said to him, "Father, I've sinned against heaven and against you. I'm no longer worthy to be called your son." But the father said to his servants, "Quick, bring the best robe, put it on him. Put a ring on his finger and sandals on his feet. Bring the fattened calf and kill it. Let's have a feast and celebrate. For this son of mine was dead and is alive. He was lost and is found." So they began to celebrate. He's lost and found. This doesn't mean, like in our culture, to be lost means, you know, you're stupid. He's not saying my son was stupid. He's saying my son was disconnected and now he's found. He is back. I love this picture of the father who, again, represents God. He just sees the faint image of his son off in the distance, and he knows, that's my boy. You know, us as parents, if you're a parent or your father, you know what this is like. I mean, I can be in the atrium, on the other side of the atrium, and I will notice my kids, how they walk. I can't even see them fully, but I'll just know that's my kid. You know, if my son is playing football in his first game, and I don't know his number, I just get there. I don't need to even see his face. He's behind pads. I know how he walks on and off the field. And I just go, that's my son. This is what this father's like. He so knows his son, so loves his son, that he can't even make out his face, but he goes. He just runs to him. He must have taken his garment, tucked it in, which is a very unmanly thing for Middle Eastern men to do. Tucks his garment in and takes off. He comes up to his son, puts a ring on his finger, probably signifying his signet ring, which is what wealthy people would have to put their stamp on deeds or stamp things wrapped in wax. This means, I'm giving you my wealth. You are my son. I'm giving you my wealth. He wraps a robe around him, which means his identity. I'm wrapping you in my identity. You are my son. He says, get that fatted calf. We are having a party. Kills the fatted calf, wanting an amazing, amazing friend. He says, this son of mine. He's not having any of this servant thing. This, okay, I'll take you back to servant. This son of mine was disconnected. He's found, and he's giving unbelievable grace, mercy, and love. Now, in the Buddhist version of this, because there is a Buddhist version, and other spiritualities have some versions of this, especially and specifically the Buddhist version. It's a lot different. Let me read you a section of the Buddhist version. It goes like this. His father, beholding the son, was struck with compassion for him. One day he saw at a distance through the window his son's figure, haggard and drawn, lean and sorrowful, filthy and dirt and dust. He took off his string of jewels, his soft attire, and put on a coarse, torn, and dirty garment, smeared his body with dust, took a basket in his right hand, and with an appearance fear-inspiring, said to the laborers, "Get on with your work, don't be lazy." By such means, he got near to his son, to whom he afterwards said, "Aye, my man, you stay and work here. Do not leave again. I will increase your wages, give whatever you need, bowls, rice, wheat, flour, salt, vinegar, and so on." Yes, you can come. You can come, my man. You can come and work. You work and I'll take care of you just like I do everybody else. In fact, as the story continues, he actually has to work off his debt for 20 years. He's got to work off his debt. See, that's what religions say. That's what's fair. Fair is fair. You rebelled, now you got to work yourself back. And even forms of Christianity are like this. You know, people flogging themselves, doing unbelievable penance, going up and down stairs on knees, punishing themselves. And this, because I got to be fair, right? I rebelled this much, so now I need this much. And that's why a lot of us younger brothers, it's hard for those of us who are younger brothers to really feel accepted and loved, because our fairness is coming back to haunt us. And we're thinking, no, God really doesn't love me, does he? That's just not fair. It's hard. It's very hard to receive and accept unmerited love and favor and grace of God, which is totally opposed to what fairness is. Now, that's the younger brother. Then there's the older brothers who are watching this happening, seeing this unfold. Meanwhile, the older brother was in the field, and when he came near the house, he heard music and dancing, and so he called one of the servants and asked him what was going on. "Well, your brother's come," he replied, "and your father has killed the fattened calf because he has him back safe and sound." The older brother became angry and refused to go in. So his father went out and pleaded with him. But he answered his father, "Look, all these years I've been slaving for you and never disobeyed your orders, yet you never gave me even a young goat so I could celebrate with my friends. But when this son of yours, who has squandered your property with prostitutes and didn't need Viagra, comes home, you kill the fatted calf for him." This is the response of older brothers. Older brothers don't openly rebel. They don't like run away. They don't use their fairness to make them rebel and get away, but their fairness manifests itself when they see somebody else getting grace, getting love, getting blessings that they don't have, then bitterness happens. Because they're all about religious obligation. That's what elder brothers are. All about obligation. Look at what he says. "I've been slaving for you all these years." Not, "Dad, I've been enjoying your presence and, you know, and working side by side with you all these years." Not that. "I've been slaving for you. I don't have joy. I'm not connected with you in a personal relationship. I've been slaving for you." That's what older brothers are like. Older brothers are like, "Man, I've been slaving at Crossroads. I've been doing two-year-olds for 2 years. Been slaving back there. I've been parking cars. People whipping me the finger. I've been slaving. Or I've been, you know, doing this thing and that thing. I've been slaving." It's not like I'm enjoying and encountering God while I serve. I'm slaving. I'm trying to do the right things. I want the right stuff to come back to me, so therefore I'm slaving. And then as elder brothers, when somebody else gets ahead of us, especially somebody who hasn't been as faithful to us, in case you haven't noticed, I'm an elder brother. I'll talk about that in a moment. I'm an elder brother. Somebody gets ahead of us. Somebody gets something that we don't have because we should have, because we're working harder, then bitterness comes up. And he's playing the comparison game now. Now, wait a minute. He gets the fatted calf after all he did wrong. I'm doing keggers in the field, and I can't even get a goat. How does that work out? You won't even give me a goat, and yet you're doing the fatted calf. This is just not fair. There's this angst that erupts. There's this difficulty that he has. That's what elder brothers do that saps our joy. It's hard to give grace to people who are doing things that we're not doing or not doing things that we are doing. And all of a sudden, our fairness, we start measuring, we start getting bitter. We start getting angry. We start thinking that God's holding out on us because I'm not getting what other people are getting. And this is what happens. Oftentimes, elder brothers, we're not the rebellious ones, at least outwardly, but eventually we'll get there internally because we don't like that other people are getting stuff that we don't have. And it just gnaws at us. It enables us to judge people, enables us to wish the worst for people silently. We don't ever do it really, you know, out loud. Because elder brothers, we know that's not a good thing, but internally, sometimes you wish for it or even cheerlead it internally. This is part of the reason. I've experienced older brothers. I am an older brother, but I've also experienced older brothers. It doesn't feel very good. When we lost our house and everything we had due to fire years ago, we were renting this house and lost everything without renter's insurance. We had friends of ours come along and give us cash, give us furniture they weren't using, help us out. And it was an amazing outpouring of grace and mercy and love. But older brothers, people who we thought were our friends, who are very committed to God, committed to the Bible, man, they did not like it at all. In fact, we started hearing back from them, you know, that this isn't right, this isn't fair. The line was, we made our bed, we ought to lie in it. You know, if we weren't responsible enough to do $150 for renter's insurance, then we shouldn't have people doing this and that. It hurts. And this is why years and years ago, we stopped publishing salaries across shows because older brothers just got all over it. Now, how's this and how's that and how come this? And it's just not worth it. It creates unbelievable angst. See, I am a physical older brother, and I also personally am a spiritual. I am a physical and spiritual older brother. Younger brothers got their issues. Older brothers got their issues. Whatever their paradigm is, some paradigm of fairness that is completely opposed to the Jesus paradigm of grace, the Jesus paradigm of love. Now, the people who are listening to Jesus talk to this, they realize something is wrong. They're smart people. They're smart people. They realize this is the third of these stories. In the first story, shepherd leaves and goes and runs. Second story, woman leaves, goes in search of. This story, no one's really leaving. I mean, the father, once he sees the son coming back, he goes and meets him. But that's not really the same in the first two. In fact, that sort of looks like fairness. Yeah, well, you know, you start coming back, God will meet you halfway. That's the way this works. You start coming back, God meets you halfway. That's kind of fair. No, that's not the way God is at all. God doesn't meet us halfway. There's something wrong in this story. And Jesus, in talking to these religious people, he's telling them something wrong. And in their culture, they understand what is wrong. Because in their culture, to be the eldest son meant that you got the lion's share of the inheritance. You had unique perks that came with it, but also you had unique responsibilities. It was the elder son's responsibility to keep the family together. And this elder son is just allowing this younger son to go out and do whatever. He's just hanging back. He's not taking an aggressive posture at all of going out and looking for this younger son. 1965, Life magazine tells a story about Donald Dawson, who went in search of his brother Daniel Dawson. Here's Life magazine right here. Julie Andrews, man, she was hot back in 1965, wasn't she? Here it is, a perilous search for a lost brother. Tells the story of Donald Dawson going out looking for his brother Daniel, his younger brother Daniel, who is behind enemy lines. And Donald sells all that he has, leaves his wife with $20, and goes in search of his younger brother. And in fact, when the Viet Cong found out that this was who was looking for his brother, they actually let him walk through the lines and let him alone because they respected the quest of an older brother looking for his younger brother. He came to be known in Vietnamese, translated, quote unquote, the brother. He was known as the brother because that's what good older brothers do. They go in search of him. And so what Jesus is saying is, I am the good older brother. Now, when you understand that he's the good older brother that actually goes in search of, wants to keep people together, all of a sudden, verses in the Bible start making sense. Like in the book of Colossians, it says that the Son is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation. He's the firstborn. He is the eldest son. And Jesus goes on and he says this. We'll read this in Luke if you haven't already. The Son of Man came to seek and save that which was lost. He's the eldest son that goes out to seek, save, bring healing and restoration to the son. When we take a look at this thing that Jesus does on an entirely different plane of grace that has never been seen before, never been seen, will never be seen again, what he's done, all of a sudden other verses in the Bible start to make different sense to us. They start popping off the page for us. Here's some of these. But that you may know the Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins, he said to the paralyzed man, I tell you, get up your mat and go home. I forgive sins, Jesus says. I forgive, I don't say go do this and that and then you'll get healed. I forgive sins. I'm the pure eldest brother, the firstborn of creation that does things out of grace and love. Here's another one. He who rejects you rejects me, but he who rejects me rejects him who sent me. Jesus says, when you reject me, you reject God. And it's not like God's going, oh, I don't like you since you reject my son. You reject the whole plan, the whole plan. Jesus says, my whole plan is one that it's not your works that earns God's favor. My whole plan is that you don't do the fairness. You don't want fairness. You do not want fairness from God. But when you reject me, you reject my plan of grace, you reject the entire character of God. So that's why when you reject me, you reject God. You don't like the grace plan. You are sufficient enough. You won't receive anything from anybody. You're just going to do it on your own and have fun. Good luck. When you reject me, you reject God. Here's another one. I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. And doesn't this one look a little bit different now? It's not Jesus saying, nah, 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 I'm the way, the truth, and life. I'm the nah, 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 don't let me, nah, nah, nah. He's like, hey, I am the way of grace. I'm the way to all who are beaten down and bitter. I'm the way of truth that says I can give you truth that you don't have right now. I am the way to a joy-filled existence that you don't have to work for and kill yourself over. If you want that way, younger brothers, if you want that way, older brothers, the way of love and grace, I'm the only one that gives you that way. I'm it. Eckhart Tolle interprets this verse this way. These words uttered by Jesus are one of the most powerful and direct pointers to the truth if understood correctly. If misinterpreted, however, they become a great obstacle. Jesus speaks of the innermost I am, the essence identity of every man and woman, every life form. In fact, he speaks of the life that you are. The life that you are, the life I am not, let me tell you right now, I am not truth. I am not truth. That is not the way I are or you are or you is or I is. It's not. I'm telling you, you're not the way, I'm not the way. You're not the truth, I'm not the truth. It's not dig deeper and come some new and light. No. There is an objective person in history that made a way that transcends any religion, spirituality, or any natural human form of reasoning. That's what I want. I want that unfair way. There's a Jesus who comes as the ultimate good elder brother for bad elder brothers and bad younger brothers. There is a good older brother, a way that comes for driven megachurch pastors. There's a good older brother that comes and offers grace. People come to a place called Crossroads at 10 a.m. in the morning. Come, breathe deep.